can't say the legislature is trying to avoid hot-button issues. They've taken up personal exemptions for vaccines, cracking down on repeat DUI offenders, and expanding the use of automated traffic cameras. Let's get the update from our legislative detective, Hannah Scott. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. So yesterday was a big cutoff day in Olympia for the House and Senate to pass their own bills out. Some died, some made it, some were still up in the air about. One big one is the vaccine personal exemptions. Of course, a big issue because of our outbreak, which is now at 73 in our state, of measles cases, mostly focused down in Clark County. There were a couple of different bills moving through the legislature. Now there is only one. Yesterday, the Democratic Senator Annette Cleveland dropped the Senate version of the bill. That one would have ended the personal exemptions for all vaccines. So what we're left is the one that already passed the House. That one ends the personal exemptions just for the MMR vaccine. And there was some disappointment. I heard from some parents and some doctors who really thought the Senate version was stronger. And they're hoping that that can be worked out as the one that's still alive makes its way through the legislature the rest of this session, which is, I'm told, a possibility.
So just to be clear, so if this version of the vaccine bill passes, what does that require you to do?
If the current version right now, the House version, goes all the way as it is currently written, it would end personal exemptions for the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. So you can't just, for philosophical reasons, decide you're not going to do it. You can still get out of it for medical and religious reasons, though.
Okay. So a religious exemption would still be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just for the personal exemption. So the parents who opt out for personal reasons are they think that they're worried about adverse reactions, or they think it's going to give their kid autism or things of that nature. It's just because they want to.
But they could then just say, but it's also my religious belief now.
And there's some documentation and some things you have to go through. You have to jump through some additional hoops to prove that it is your religious reasons. It's not, you can't just say it. It doesn't work.
I'd be interested to see how that goes, but moving on.
Yes. Okay. Also at the same time yesterday, Democratic Senator Emily Randall introduced a new vaccine measure that is meant to send a message to Congress.
We want to hold big business and big pharma accountable. And so this Senate joint memorial calls on the federal government to repeal the liability shield that they put into place years ago, so that when family or a child does have a true adverse reaction, that they're able to hold big pharma accountable for that.
So in the 80s, there was this law passed that shields big pharma and they can't from any liability. If there are those kids, which there's a small percentage of kids who do have an adverse reaction, this is sending a message to Congress to undo this. And the hope is that it would get those parents who choose not to vaccinate their kids because they don't trust big pharma, that this would kind of help build that trust, which is actually a conversation going on. Parents who say, you want to end our personal exemptions, get rid of this law first.
Although I believe the reason that law was passed was that without it, the companies were unwilling to produce the vaccines.
They
were at all.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, a whole group of them said, we're not giving you any vaccines then if you're going to do this. Yeah. So we'll see how that plays out.
DUIs.
So repeat DUI offenders, we see them all the time here. 8, 9, 10, 11 DUIs. Sometimes they're deadly. And there's been an effort from Republican Senator Mike Padden to make a fourth DUI in 15 years a felony, which comes with prison time, as opposed to the current law, which is 4 DUIs in 10 years. That bill failed yesterday, despite some last-minute theatrics on the Senate floor to try to get it up for a vote. It did not come up. At the same time, though, over in the House, Democratic Representative Roger Goodman's bill did pass, and it is also a bill that targets a lot of things having to do with DUI, but specific to repeat DUI offenders. And he wants to go the route of expanding the use of ignition interlocks.
We extend the period during which you have to use the ignition interlock device for a number of different reasons. Again, if you have minors in the car, if you try to tamper or remove the device, or if you had a device in another car that's sitting in your garage, a lot of people are trying to do this. We are going to extend the use of the interlock device until you behave properly.
But isn't it locking people up, maybe repeat offenders especially, who drive drunk that many times, a better way to keep the public safe? I asked him.
What we found is that it's not necessarily cost-effective or even effective in reducing drunk driving to lock people up. We want to have the car hold people accountable, basically. So every time you try to start the car, you have to blow into that breathalyzer. If there's alcohol, the car doesn't start. And we've prevented thousands of cars from getting on the roads over the years, particularly on the weekends, And therefore prevented hundreds or maybe even thousands of deaths as well. So this ignition interlock program has been very, very successful.
But he admits like 30% of people don't follow that law with the ignition interlock device. So
yeah. So the reach back bill, which would have gone back 15 years to count your Ford DUIs, that failed.
That failed. But here's where we're at with that. I am told by some folks who are behind the sponsor and also some Democrats in the Senate that what the hope is here is that Goodman's bill will now go over to the Senate and that the Senate will add some of these amendments to maybe to get that look back period back in there, that extended look back period. It's going to be a battle. I don't know that this ends up getting done because there's a lot of pushback. The overall theme and agenda right now in Olympia is restorative justice, keeping people out of jail, not putting more people in. Yeah. That look back bill, that 15-year bill from Senator Patton, has an $8 million price tag over 4 years. Cost is an issue there, too. So I'll keep you posted as we move through the session. Automated cameras expanding in Seattle to help with congestion. Remember those? They were going to nab you if you were in the transit-only lanes or blocking the box, blocking the intersections. They're dead. Democratic Representative Joe Fitzgibbon not happy.
You know, I always knew that this bill was going to be hard because there's a lot of opposition to traffic safety cameras from Republicans in particular, but some Democrats as well. I thought that we might have had a chance with this because of the significant congestion problems in downtown Seattle right now. I wouldn't say I'm totally surprised, but I am disappointed.
Yep. Both versions in the Senate also dead, too.
Yeah. Hooray.
Yeah. Although I think, I don't know about you, I've noticed a different attitude among drivers lately. Maybe it's just the threat of the idea that they might be snapped in the box. I mean, people are really desperate to get out of the box if they can at all avoid it. What usually makes it difficult is when somebody either cuts in front during a traffic jam or the lights just remain green and you're trying to anticipate and you get trapped.
Well, you listen to that Fitzgibbon cut and you hit the crux of the issue. It's being pushed as a safety measure, but he says when you look at the congestion problems.
Right.
So in the same sentence he said, it's about safety. Oh, but it's really about congestion. Well, which is it? And so I don't think they're buying the argument yet for an expansion like that.
Well, and originally that bill was going to make it for the whole state. By the time it came, right before it died, it was just specific to Seattle. It would have only allowed for this in Seattle. And FYI, so while it is dead for this year, it will absolutely, he says, be introduced again at the beginning of the next session in January. And he hopes to have enough support to get it done then. So we'll keep you posted.
Well, in the meantime, has anybody discussed the idea of timing the lights so that you're not even allowed to go into the intersection? I mean, the problem is when you have a string of green lights and traffic is jammed and the guy behind you says,
I can make it.
It's going to move pretty soon because I see the lights up ahead of green. So, he's nudging the guy ahead of him to go into the intersection and the guy gets trapped through no fault of his own.
Well, driving through South Lake Union earlier this week, I saw an 18-wheeler that blocked the box for two full signals.
Yeah.
He was going north-south against Mercer, and he'd blocked the entire westbound direction and eastbound of Mercer there. I was like, what are you doing?
I get so many pictures when I tweet about this story of the buses, of the trucks, of the people, pedestrians in there.
Well, then I guess if that continues, then the attitude in the next legislature might be somewhat different because now everybody will have a story about how they waited half an hour because somebody blocked them.
Yeah, and it's a big letdown for City Council and Mayor Jenny Durkin, by the way. They asked for this legislation, so maybe next year.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke Points. Let's go. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Today, we have a rapid-fire series of listener questions. Are you ready?
Yes. Let me make sure I'm plugged in properly. Yes.
Here we go. First question from listener Eric. He is not happy with the new configuration of 6th Avenue where Seneca exited into downtown. He says it's been a disaster since the city restriped it. What's that about?
Well, you might remember, I'm not sure if you had already taken off when I did this in my choke point last week, talking about the new bus tunnel and how the buses are going to be kicked out of the bus tunnel. One of the ways they were going to make up for all those extra buses on the road is they were going to make 6th Avenue North a bus corridor. Well, that striping went in over the weekend, and what we have right where northbound Seneca off-ramp comes onto 6th Avenue, there used to be three lanes there going north. Now there's only one, and it's the far left lane. So it goes left lane, through lane, middle lane, bus only, right lane, exit only to I-5 northbound. And so people getting off at Seneca there, that was confusion and all the striping and the merging led this to back up onto I-5 earlier in the week. I think people are starting to get used to it now, but that's one of kind of the unintended consequences here. The good news is and what you need to realize, that bus only lane is only open for buses, is only four buses from 3 to 7 p.m. So in the morning, you can use that lane. But it was a big switch. Drivers were kind of like, what? And so that's just something we're going to have to work our way through.
So you got to read the fine print on the sign.
Correct. And when you're coming off Mercer and taking a right, that sign is basically right above your head. So it's very difficult to notice that. But the striping went in. It started backing things up as people were kind of confused as to what's happening there.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about that for a while. Let's go to potholes now. Listener Carolyn blew out two tires during the recent snowstorm. She heard a rumor that the city was going to reimburse drivers for some of their pothole damages. Is that true?
No. The rumor is just that. It's a rumor. Seattle does not have some special deal going on right now for people who suffered pothole damage during the recent snowstorms. You have always been, and you can file a claim against the city if you want to. And I put that form up at mynorthwest.com if you think the city is to blame for pothole damage to your car. But you need to be realistic here. The city needs to be very negligent for you to get paid, like a pothole that they've been hearing about and hearing about and hearing about and didn't do anything for months. Snowstorm related stuff, you're probably not going to get much luck. You can always try. And if you think about it, the city's been replacing and filling in 1,000 potholes a week since this storm, and it's likely going to be months before they catch up on that.
Didn't I bring this up before? But we can send a man to the moon. We can send a spacecraft to Mars. But nobody's been able to design a pothole-proof type of concrete. Why is that?
Well, and especially when you consider all the rain and the snow that we had, and then the snow melted and it got through the pavement and cracked.
Well, roads are outdoors. Sorry, but that happens.
Yeah, so we'll have to find a way to make that happen. Maybe we need to get to Minnesota and talk to some people there about what they do to make that happen. But yeah, that's an issue.
Okay. Listener Jerry wants an update on the largest construction project in Mill Creek history, which has closed a major road there for 8 months now.
Yeah, and it is. Have been made driving around my neighborhood a giant pain in the you know what, because we live on the detour route for this. He's talking about 35th Avenue Southeast. I talked about this a year ago. It connects the Mill Creek area to 132nd, which is a major east-west commuter corridor that gets you to I-5 or to Highway 9. It's been out of commission now for 8 months because it's a little low spot in the road, and there is a lake over to the right, and Little Penny Creek runs through the area. And whenever we get big rainstorms, 35th floods like crazy. I mean, we're talking all the way across. We have beaver that go across this thing when it's like that. So they finally just shut it down. They raised the road several feet. They got rid of the culverts in the area that were backing things up as well. And so there should be no more flooding because it reopened on Monday, and Penny Creek will be right where it belongs, underneath the road and not on top of it. Yeah, $5 million project for Mill Creek, the largest in their city's history.
Well, interesting road design that you design it for the creek to flow over the road, but now that's been fixed.
Yeah, and the people are no longer on Seattle Hill Road avoiding that in my neighborhood.
Yes. That's why that one that got priority.
Yeah, of course.
And finally, listener Ursula, who apparently listens to us quite a bit because she has all sorts of problems driving, asked about the protected bike lane on 65th through the Ravenna neighborhood. Ursula says she never sees any bikes, and the road now backs up for 2 miles every day because of this road diet. What gives?
Well, the city has eliminated a lane of traffic on 65th because they believe that's where a bike lane needs to go. And so what they've done is part of the stretch has a protected bike lane. It had been striped but not separated from traffic for the last couple of months. Well, the new traffic blockage, the buffers went in this week. So they've got those little the flexible posts that are there. So what Ursula had been describing is people have been using both the bike lane and the regular travel lane. And it's like Monte Carlo in there. The people are jockeying for position and going crazy. And well, now you can't do that anymore. And those backups are going to continue. As for the actual number of bikes who use 65th, the city doesn't have a counter on that stretch of bike lanes, so we don't really know. All we have is anecdotal evidence from people like Ursula and other drivers who say they never see anybody on that stretch, and they're not exactly sure why they decided to put the bike lane there.
Ursula, I would say that you need to urge your fellow drivers to ditch their cars and use that bike lane.
She's also reporting driving through neighborhoods, which I know a lot of people are doing now too, which is also not a very good idea.
Your daily dose of kindness now. We'll take you back to 2015 in Fargo, North Dakota. Couple Mike and Jenny Stevens opened a Little Caesars franchise. New to business, they didn't expect a few things, including discovering people digging through their dumpsters looking for leftover pizza. But the more Jenny thought about it, the more she realized that, yeah, they serve a wide range of clientele, some who don't dig through trash for food, but still are only scraping by to get a meal.
I do have people that unfortunately come in with change, and they're embarrassed, and I just tell them, you don't have to be embarrassed. This is helping you feed your family.
She took that a step further, though, and tells KVLY-TV that she put a sign in the drive-thru window. It says, "You're a human being and worth more than a meal from a dumpster. Please come in during operating hours for a couple slices of hot pizza and a cup of water at no charge. No questions asked."
Don't feel embarrassed if you're hungry and it's, you know, you don't want to do what others do, you know, stand on the corner for, you know, handouts. You feel down about that. You're more than welcome to come here and grab a couple slices.
And for 2 years now, she's kept that promise and estimates she's given away more than 140,000 slices of pizza. That's about $70,000 worth of food. She also now gives away leftovers to food pantries and shelters and recently started a GoFundMe to help back this act of kindness.
Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers, and here he is, Danny O'Neill. So just to get me caught up, Earl Thomas is gone, but very rich now.
That's correct. He has gone to Baltimore. He has gotten $55 million to be paid out to him over the next four seasons. He's going to
How much is guaranteed?
$32, I think.
Wow. That's
$32 million that he's assured.
Not too bad.
Fully guaranteed at signing. He's gonna
How many more years do you think he has?
Well, I would bet on two. And I would say that three would be great. And if he gets 4 years, it is going to be one of the all-time great NFL careers. If he has another four seasons to play.
Not bad.
He's an awesome player.
Enough for a foundation and, you know, a second chapter.
Well, I'd say that we all knew he was leaving. That was pretty evident. The holdout, the post saying the disrespect has been well noted and will not be forgotten. The middle finger as he left the field. Right. It still kind of hurt. I was bummed. I'm going to miss Earl Thomas.
Is he getting the money he wanted, though?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. There you go. It worked out.
For him? What about for me? It's not going to work out for me. He's not going to be playing for the Seahawks anymore.
Well. No, but we do have, a new kicker. Jason Myers.
That's correct. I'm pumped about this.
Why?
Do you know why? Hmm. No more spoiled milk. Have you heard my theory on kickers?
No.
Kickers, once they start to turn, they're like a milk that's past its date in there. And the second time you sniff and ask yourself, oh, do you think this is still good? That's the time you throw it out. You get one sniff where you can, oh, I think this might have turned, and we'll give it another shot. If you have to sniff again,
who
if there's
have we
another
done that
game.
With?
Oh, Blair Walsh, Sebastian Janikowski. Both of those guys stumbled. Walsh was awful. Walsh, you talked yourself into the idea that he's going to get through this. Yes, it looks awful, but his history as a kicker, he's going to come through this, and he never did. Janikowski was merely just below average. Mm. Like, he wasn't stomach. You weren't doubled over hurling after the consumption.
Should we still regret Hauschka?
Yeah.
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 He's
and
doing
it,
okay.
And I say that at the time, I was fully on board with
yeah,
the,
I remember
let,
that.
Let Hauschka go. And if somebody's going to give him a raise, find somebody else, because he was coming off of a tough year. Mm-hmm. He was a carton that I was suspicious of. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to throw him out yet, but I'm not exactly going to say.
You weren't sure the difference between use by and sell by?
Yeah, and that sort of question with him. And Jason Myers was really good for the Seahawks in training camp last year, and he's coming off a Pro Bowl season. So at least we've got a fresh container of milk. He's not going to go bad for at least another 6 months.
Is he good milk? Is he grass-fed, organic,
oh my God.
Free range?
Well, how long is this metaphor going to go?
He's small. He's small. Like, does
as long
that
as
mean
he's got a big leg?
Does that mean he does have a big leg? But generally, so maybe he has no no GMOs.
Okay.
Because he's tiny.
Now
he's
I got to cut this off because you're ruining my lunch. Now can we talk about a little theory that Matt Calkins proposed in the Seattle Times, which is that one of the reasons, and it's kind of going back to Earl Thomas, but his theory was that Pete Carroll's betting on himself, and that as a former college coach, he's used to having a lot of players who are 4 years and out,
uh-huh.
and he likes to, you know, build them from scratch. Is that a viable theory?
Well, yeah, but every NFL coach essentially does that. I would say that Pete Carroll has kept guys around way longer than I thought he would. That I thought when he and John Schneider got here that you were going to see more and more players once they reach their 4 years and came off their rookie contracts and were free agents, that they wouldn't re-sign them. That they would say, hey, we're going to stay young. We're going to stay young. He valued veteran defenders. Yeah. And the idea that they're letting Earl Thomas go or letting Earl Thomas walk after 9 seasons, that's not exactly betting on yourself. That's saying that, hey, we got everything we could out of the nucleus of that Super Bowl team. We got everything we could out of those guys. And things went a little off track later on because you had some players that are headstrong. And we're kind of rebooting. And the guys, the veterans that we're keeping are guys that are not headstrong, Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright. But if this is all of a sudden going to be, we're only going to have guys with 4 years or less of experience, that's never how Pete's coached.
And I was shocked while I was gone that Gonzaga lost something.
Yeah, they lost to St. Mary's. I hope they're on the bubble now. I hope that's a one-bid league as far as I'm concerned. The WCC and their weak sisters of the port. No, they did. They lost to St. Mary's in the final. And they didn't play all that well. Gonzaga is still going to be a number one seed. Don't you worry. Your tuition dollars have funded a juggernaut.
Because I just can't keep all the conferences straight. So this is not part of the final.
This
four.
Is not the WAC. It's not the MAC. It's the WCC, and it's certainly not the Pac-12, which the Huskies are playing in today. People have said that maybe Gonzaga should go into the Pac-12, which I'm all for as long as they field a football team. And we get to pound their intramural flag football, just destroy them. And then, fine, you can come and win basketball, but we are going to take your face and we're going to grind it into the mud in football because real schools play football.
I don't think they have room for a football field on that campus.
Well, I don't care if they're any good at it. I just want to beat them. Can we beat them at something? They whoop us at basketball.
But there's a whole bunch of it. Do they play soccer? I mean, what are you so...
But who really cares about that? That's just exercise.
Why do you sports guys always have to take competition that far?
Oh, because it's sports. Why can't you? It's the whole idea. What? That's the one place where we get to be lunatics about it. What? We're allowed to.
Why can't a little school specialize in basketball and just be happy with that?
Oh,
why do they have to expand?
I'm all for them specializing it. I just think if they want to join the big boy conference, they should get whooped by the big boys in a big boy sport.
It's all about getting whooped. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Hannah Scott is here. Let's talk about universal health care. Now that, the president doesn't like Obamacare, obviously, so should the states go it on their own? And I'd figure if any state would try to do that, it'd be ours. So
for sure, yeah, yes.
So how far has that gone?
So there were a couple of different bills that we've talked about since the beginning of session. One looked at, has been introduced multiple years, that would have had like a capital gains tax and really put us on the... created a universal health care program in our state. That has not gone anywhere. But what we did pass yesterday in the Senate is a bill that creates a path forward by creating a work group to study the feasibility of this. Democratic Senator Emily Randall proposed it.
Healthcare access that should be a right. We live in the greatest state, in the greatest country, and no one in Washington should be afraid of losing their home or... not being able to afford food because they get sick.
Lots of opposition from Republicans, even to just the creation of this work group, including from Senator Steve O'Bannon.
We are taking up a work group that will basically study different approaches, which include a single-payer system because of roughly 5% who aren't insured. That makes little sense to me, particularly when we know the vast majority of those who are insured through their employer are very satisfied. Why would we even make the effort of studying an approach that would turn that system upside down?
The answer, of course, from Democrats is that, you know, there are a lot of others who can't afford their health care. This is a crisis. It's a problem. We need to look at this and be the leader. So here's what this will do. They'll create this work group. It passed, by the way, on party lines that will include everybody, public, community health advocates, businesses, health care providers, and lawmakers. And they'll come up with the best way to implement a universal health care plan, study various options, and also talk about the big question on how to pay for it. None of that laid out yet. So this is just trying to find a way to come up with that. They would have to report back to the legislature with their findings and recommendations by November of next year, and then we'd go from there.
So
there's that.
Okay. I just want to ask, though, on this, I don't know how deeply you got into the discussion there, but is there anybody who seriously argues that there should be some people who, even though they need treatment, should not get it on account of them being poor? I mean, we all...
Has anybody argued that for that? I've not heard
that.
No,
I mean, everybody... So that's, and that's what we're trying to figure out. And I think most people who work... It gets back to the homeless thing again. will have a story about how a lot of these people who we see living in tents, I mean, a lot of them, I understand, can be bad actors, but there are others, they had cancer, or they had something that rendered them completely unable to work, and they spent their savings, and now they've got nothing. I don't see how society saves any money, you see, by letting that happen. And if it's only 5%, why couldn't the state just set up an insurer of last resort for that 5%?
Well, and I don't know the answer to exactly that. I know a lot of the people, specifically if we're talking about homeless people, people dealing with addiction, they are being signed up for Medicaid now, right? That's how we're getting everyone those treatment options. So I think the focus here is more on those small business owners who can't afford to do that employer health care, or people who don't have employer options, you know, who are buying in the private market. That is, I think, the focus here. But I think for the poor people, they go on Medicaid, and I think this would hopefully get people off Medicaid. We'll see how it all plays out. But
all right, it's Hannah Scott. Emerald City Comic Con gets underway today in downtown Seattle. The cast of Stranger Things will be there. The cast of Boy Meets World will be there, along with a couple of Starfleet officers and one of the doctors from Doctor Who. But perhaps the biggest draw at the show this year, a group of friends who sit at a table and play a game. Here is Dyer Oxley.
Travis Willingham and his friends launched a sort of passion project back in 2015. They just began live streaming a game they play on Twitch. Travis and his friends are all Hollywood voice actors, so they figured they'd garner a little bit of an audience, but what they got was thousands upon thousands of fans.
Critical Role is a group of voice actors who are playing their own home game of D&D, and we play every week for a few hours where we create characters and give them unique voices, all while improvising in the Dungeons & Dragons game universe.
That's right, Dungeons & Dragons, D&D. Just as TV fans settle in for their favorite show each week, thousands of spectators now tune in to Twitch every Thursday night and watch Critical Role play D&D. Dungeons & Dragons has entered a new era and is more popular today than it ever has been in its 45-year history. Now, for the uninitiated, this is a role-playing game. There's a Dungeon Master, which is like an author of a story, and then there are players, which are characters in that story, but there are rules and risks. At least, that's it in a nutshell.
The fans are there to watch it and engage and enjoy the adventure with us in real time. Right? It's not pre-recorded. It's not something that's been shot and then edited. You might as well be sitting at that table with us for those 3, 4, 5 hours, however long the game is.
This weekend, Critical Role fans, commonly called Critters, will be among more than 90,000 people expected to flock to downtown Seattle for Emerald City Comic Con. Featured just as prominently as George Takei or Doctor Who's Peter Capaldi will be the cast of Critical Role. It should be said that this is not an isolated phenomenon. There is an array of D&D shows and podcasts all feeding off the fervor for this game.
It's unprecedented, honestly. There is this huge surge in popularity right now. Dungeons & Dragons is really benefiting a lot from that right now.
That's Greg Tito. He's with Wizards of the Coast, which is the Renton-based game company that produces Dungeons & Dragons.
The books are flying off the shelves, and you know, we've seen double-digit growth for Dungeons & Dragons over the last 5 years. 2017 was, as far as we can tell, the most successful year in Dungeons & Dragons history, and then 2018 blew that out of the water.
So with all of this success, the Critical Role cast recently decided to start yet another passion project, an animated series based off the story from their games. They started a Kickstarter campaign to fund this earlier this month. In less than 8 hours, they met their goal, $750,000, but they didn't stop there. As of this week, they are 957% funded. That's nearly $7.2 million from 53,000 fans. And this all started just like any other game of D&D. Some friends just wanted to get together and hang out.
You know, getting together on a weekly basis and hanging out with your friends and telling stories and laughing and has a benefit beyond what I think even the creators of Dungeons & Dragons kind of thought it would be, back when it was made in 1974.
Wow. That's like football money. So, Dyer, I've never seen this. So, what is, describe to me what it's like to watch them play Dungeons & Dragons.
It's the same thing, the same response I get when people want to know why people would watch people play video games. Mm-hmm. I know multiple people, I know multiple podcasters out there that are airing their Dungeons & Dragons games. The thing that's different with Critical Role, however, is these are Hollywood voice actors. Mm-hmm. Travis, for example, I know him as like Thor from the animated Marvel films, but he's been in a whole bunch of anime. He's been a whole bunch of video games. And there's like this cult of people. Aaron Mason, who works here at Cairo Radio, is one of them. Mm-hmm. They follow voice actors. So there's a passionate following. So it's really interesting to watch them not only just play, but they're doing voices and they're actually right. playing around with this.
So, I mean, last time I played Dungeons & Dragons, it was on a table at a friend's house and it was, you know, all written out on paper with little yeah. playing pieces. So is that what we're watching here?
They still do it. The folks that I really like to get into it, they actually get landscapes. It almost looks like little tiny, like, models of little trees, you know, and the little tiny fake grass on there. And they'll actually get figures and they'll play around. That's their field. They're still doing everything Dungeons & Dragons, and mm-hmm. everything plays at the roll of a dice, a 20-sided die. And, yeah, you can kind of take it wherever you want.
I think that's amazing. And so the audiences, you can actually now make your living doing this then.
Well, it's kind of like podcasting, because a lot of people think that you can make a living doing that, and I think a lot of folks are finding out that's not necessarily true right now. I think if you're a famous voice actor and uh-huh. you get together with your famous voice actor friends, that makes it a lot easier. But there are folks that are doing this. Geek & Sundry is another outlet, and they have a partnership, I think, with Critical Role, where they do get famous actors, and they will do games. Will Wheaton from Star Trek has a whole show about tabletop games, and they just play tabletop games. With other kind of notable figures.
So yeah. conceivably, if you got a group of famous guys to yeah. play Monopoly,
yeah.
you could turn that into a play-by-play
podcast. I see where your mind is going here, Dave, and you pick a game and I will be there.
I'm looking for games that I could probably do, like Scrabble. Well, I know, actually, Scrabble's been broadcast for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I don't know, maybe if we did voices or if we just kind of dressed up, I don't know. But I will play Scrabble with you.
I'm not dressing up. let's talk about Comic-Con, because it seems to get bigger every year. Now, is Seattle in any way special, or do we see similar-sized conventions all over the country now?
Well, I call it the Nerd West. Like, a lot of folks don't realize this. They point to tech and some other little signs there, but this is a very geeky region. It's not really in your face, but Emerald City Comic-Con is one of the largest in the world, I would argue. We also have another one of the largest conventions here, PAX, at the other end of the year, and that's just for video games, and that's a whole other world. And then you have all these other little small Comic-Cons that pop up. I volunteered with the Renton mm-hmm. one. So,
well, PAX, is that where they have like a stadium set up where people, a live crowd, watches video games?
Oh, yeah.
Play? Yeah.
Yeah. And then we've also had, you know, other esports going on here as well, but PAX is a giant video game thing. You could ride a dinosaur there. At least last time I went, you could ride a dinosaur uh-huh. there for a video game. But last estimates, the numbers aren't really made as public. 90,000 people go to Emerald City Comic Con. I know some that fly in from out of the country, from out of the state, and they, you know, they fill up hotels.
So
Airbnbs.
This is why they need a bigger convention center, basically. Would you predict that? Because I'm looking at that pit now. I mean, that's huge. They're going to be able to fill that with people going to conventions like this.
I think once that convention center fills in, I would be very interested to watch PAX and Emerald City Comic Con to see the rise of that. Because if you track that from the, 1,500 people they started with back in 2003 or 4 to over 90,000 now, and I think they're maxing out. They're filling up the Hyatt. They're filling up the Sheraton. They're doing stuff at the Showbox. If they get more space at that convention center, we could rival San Diego. We could rival New York.
Wow. And they're all getting off at that one little Union Street exit.
Yeah.
Dyer, just quickly, when you say they're flying in, is that under their own power?
I knew you were going to do a nerd quip. I just knew. I didn't know if it was going to be Star Trek. I didn't know if it was going to be something. And then
you
I was going
right
to tell
into
you.
That one.
I know.
Dyer Oxley anchors the Northwest Nerd podcast at mynorthwest.com. Thanks, Dyer.
Thank you.
I had a conversation with Rachel Bell, and she has developed a fascination with the aftershocks that rumble through families when someone takes a home DNA test and finds something out that they didn't want to. It can bring people together. It can push family members apart. It can change the way you see yourself and your parents or your kids. It can expose lies, and it can also create New Lies.
Seattle's Alice Argasino grew up Greek. Like Big Fat Greek Wedding level Greek.
We're Greek, always talking about Greek history. And I really felt like I look like the Greeks. When I went to Greece, I thought, oh my gosh, that's who I look like. So we would go to Greek festivals when I was growing up. I took Greek mythology classes. I studied Greek and Greece. I went to Greece several times.
And when Alice had children, she skipped the baby naming books and took inspiration from Greek gods and goddesses.
So my oldest daughter is Athena. My second daughter is Alayla. Our dog is Aphrodite. And our hedgehog is Hermes.
But last year, Alice took a 23andMe test. And I think you can guess where this story is going. It turns out, Alice isn't Greek at all. She's British.
I felt cheated, actually. You know, to think that, oh, I'm exotic. I always used to tease my ancestors were frisky. You know, we were all over the place, you know, Cherokee and Greek. And then to find out that I have absolutely nothing that even seems remotely interesting as my ancestry is just, it's unfortunate. I think it's a bit depressing, actually.
Alice raised her daughters in the same Greek culture that she was raised in. And she hasn't had the heart to tell them the news. And she can't just quit Greece cold turkey.
No, I can't stop doing my Greek stuff because my children still believe that they're Greek. Mm-hmm. And we named them after the Greek goddesses. And so I will perpetuate the myth. I will be that one parent that continues to lie to my children so that on my deathbed, you know, I can relay this earth-shattering news. And no, I probably won't. But if and when they do a DNA test, they'll find out what their history is.
Taking a 23andMe test is a risk. You may find out information that you don't want to find out. So think hard before you take one. Do you want to have regrets or live in blissful ignorance? I hope her children don't listen to the radio.
Well, what is she? The children are going to take DNA tests one day. I mean, this is the way. I will not take one unless I'm forcibly, you know, if somebody puts a swab in my mouth and makes me.
Call the police if that happens, please. Yeah. Or at least tell me and I'll call for you.
I will. I just, for me, I don't like the fact that this DNA is now owned by a company. What are they going to do with it? I'm not worried about what might be revealed about me. But I do find that a lot of people, and especially white people, who love to say something like, I'm 1/32nd Cherokee.
Yeah.
They're finding out zero. I don't know why people love to claim that, but they're finding out, oh, I don't have any Native American ancestry after all.
That is actually one of the most interesting things for me, is how we identify ourselves and what that means to us. Because humans are very into telling you what they are and what they are like, and mm-hmm. I'm in this group and I'm in this category. And yeah, this test is kind of messing that up for a lot of people.
Well, in the Greek culture especially, I mean, I fell in love with Greece when I went there 10 years ago, and I had a Greek wedding. I had, you know, and I'm
oh,
not,
you did?
I'm not Greek at all, but yeah, I with the food and sort of the theme and this and that, I just love the Greek culture. I brought home a cat from Greece.
Oh boy.
If you do feel this connection to a tribe, to a culture, and you practice it day in and day out, how do you quit that when you find out you don't belong?
And should you have to? Then cultural appropriation? I mean, let's say, you know, you were raised in a family that had adopted you and they had a different culture. You know, mm-hmm. let's say you were born not Jewish, but you grew up with a Jewish family. Does that mean you're not? I mean, mm-hmm. so, you know, if she likes this culture and it's a part of her and her heart, yeah. I think who cares?
And
just
the Greeks
keep
would
at
invite
it.
Her. They're the ones that'll invite you off
the
street
so too.
To have you for dinner, so she'll be welcomed with open arms.
I don't know what I think about her keeping the secret from her children, yeah. because I think that if this secret was kept from her, which it kind of was just genetically, she would have been upset. So I don't know.
I think she should tell her kids.
I do too.
Yeah,
her daughters are teenagers, so it could be that they're in that angsty stage and they'd be like, why did you name me this?
Lash out.
Maybe she's just waiting for that teenage stage to be over. And when they're 20 years old, she can tell them their true boring identity.
These are great stories. Do you have
Thank
any more
you.
For us?
Yeah, I think I'll have one more tomorrow. I was debating whether or not I was going to do it, but I'm going to do it because both of these two stories were disappointments and heartache. And this third story is actually something good that came out of a 23andMe test. So let's end on a positive note tomorrow on Seattle's Morning News.
I love good news. So you can always hear Rachel at this time on Seattle's Morning News, and you can check out her podcast, Your Last Meal. Love it. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks.
We're all one cheek swab away from being a cultural appropriator.
Keep in mind, though, too, my husband did take his cheek swab DNA test, got his results, and about a year and a half later, got an updated email saying, oh, we've taken you off this ethnicity and put you on this. So they're changing his results, too, based on...
His ethnicity is changing.
His ethnicity is... It's a fluid ethnicity. Yeah, there's a spectrum, Dave.
Okay.
So, she might still be Greek.
So, my current ethnicity is such and such, yeah. But you're tomorrow, open, who knows?
You're open to change.
And a lot of people don't trust 23andMe either. Because,
is that the case?
Yeah, because of, apparently they don't use as much DNA.
We just have to have a commission on ethnicity where we each appear before the commission and people who know ethnicity just give you assign you one, which you then have to keep.